Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Katya Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the US election and the huge sums of money, billions of dollars being spent by Republicans and Democrats hoping to win in November. Who's donating the cash? And what impact does it all have on American democracy? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we'll be hearing about Zambia's Energy Plan B as the main source of power, the Kariba Dam, is shut off due to a drought in southern Africa. And in Sierra Leone, women make up more than half the small farmers that till the soil, but they have the biggest struggles to access the land. Why is that?
If I want to farm, then I don't have the cash. If you want to go for this brand, they'll tell you categorically that I just don't want to give my land to a woman. I just want you to bring somebody as if, okay, this is your man. We are going to hand over the land to the man and then you pay the money. We know that you're the one that is farming.
It's Tuesday, the 10th of September. First, we go to Nairobi. The news from Kenya has been heartbreaking over the last few days. 21 children died in a fire at a boarding school last week. They really were children, some as young as six. About 17 others are still missing, their grief-stricken parents camping out at the school waiting for news. There have been other arson attacks on schools since this, the most recent one. These children join a grim list of more than 100 others who've died in school-related fires in the last two decades in Kenya. 10 girls died in a fire in 2017, and the deadliest fire to date is the one in 2001 in which 67 children died. A recent report from the Ministry of Education says there were 126 cases of arson in boarding schools in just 1 year. In 2021, there was an average of 3 fires a week. So the problem is well documented, but it continues. These fires happen in mostly boarding schools, and the Education Ministry says learners are mostly responsible for setting them. Kenyan parents send their children to boarding schools because they believe to provide a better education than day schools. Many are now changing their minds, citing unsatisfactory safeguarding at these schools.
My name is Ashley Wangare Gikaru. I attended a public boarding school in Kiambu County. My experiences in high school were a bit different. I would miss my mom. I would miss her cooking because the food there was really disgusting. In my school, our classes were a bit congested. We used to have emergency windows, emergency doors, emergency stairs, but we really never had any safety training from no one. And I remember during that time we had a strike. It was around 2014. The school really handled the matter really poorly. This is a group of young girls trying to bring out the grievances, you know, being democratic as possible. They had to go for backup, you know, for assistance from the area police station, which was really chaotic because they came, they had guns, they were shooting on there. Students, you know, went stampeding and really had a lot of casualties, which was, you know, it could have been prevented if there was proper response. At least maybe the principal would have called us to a hall, let her know why are we striking personally, you know. Nothing has changed. Nothing is new. The food is still the same till date. I would really not want to let my child go off my wing, not in a boarding school. I'd really prefer them to school in a day school where I get to see them or even have them homeschooled if I can afford it.
Julius Ogoni went to a boarding school in the 1980s, and he later sent his son to one as well. He's a disaster management specialist, and he told me that slipping standards are behind the fires. So you went to boarding school, right?
Yes.
How long ago was it?
Oh, ages back, man. I entered Form 1 in 1979.
Right. And so you spent all your high school you were in?
Yes, from one to form six.
Okay. That's a while ago. Tell us, what was it like? Did you get any training on how to deal with a fire or any other safety training while you were there?
Yes. And more so some of us who are scouts. That was part of the training, firefighting, first aid, search and rescue. We had all those within the scouting movement.
Was that particular to your school or was it taught at all schools in Kenya?
It was a mandatory requirement to be taught in all schools.
Does that happen today?
No.
Do you know why not?
You know, things exist in paper, but there's something called enforcement. They're not being enforced, but they're there in paper with a laxity from the Ministry of Education.
What about the teachers? I mean, can they take the initiative themselves?
Well, there are some schools where the teachers take the initiative to train, do fire drills for students, teach them first aid, mock drills so that students are prepared. But majority of schools where there are no strong movements of scouts and guides, if it happens, it happens. But there's a requirement that this thing should be in place.
So let's talk about the recurring school fires in Kenya, and especially boarding schools. Can you explain why you think they happen so frequently? Because we report about school fires in Kenya quite a lot. Of course, there are other fires, but school fires seem to be a very particular problem.
Okay, let's start. Is it accidental? That's one. Fire can be accidental. Two, is it human error which causes that fire? Three, is it man-made?
And when you say man-made, do you mean deliberate?
Yes. When a child decides I want to burn because they are discontent, they have got a grudge against the school, the teachers are not listening or the parents are not listening, the community are not listening, then they say, okay, now we are going to riot. Then they just light a fire. That's a man-made problem.
So
if you look at it accidental, it could be there was a fault. Like you said, there's an electrical fault. But still, we have what we call routine inspection and maintenance of infrastructure. There are people who are supposed to be doing routine inspection of even the dormitories. Make sure the electricals are okay, installations are okay, there are no leakages, and even building inspectors. Because actually, people who are supposed to be inspecting buildings are the government officers from the Ministry of Works and Housing. And there's a routine timetable which they are supposed to follow and inspect schools. You know, make sure that the buildings are okay, the fire extinguishers are in place and they are working. You know, there are fire blankets, the escape routes are clear, the fencing around the school is secure, things like that.
And the children know what to do in case of a fire.
Yes, the children are trained, are drilled that in case of a fire, this is the escape route. Assembly point will be in such a place. So there's a lot which we need to put in place to make sure that our children are safe.
You have a child in boarding school, right, do you?
My son was in boarding school from class 6 to form 4.
Right, so you had a child in boarding school. When your son was at the boarding school, did he know any of these things? Was his school safe? Were you satisfied?
Yes, it was, because as a parent, whenever we went for parents' meeting, these are some of the things we used to talk about with the school authorities. Okay, I mean, I made it as a personal initiative every time we are in school that make sure that the dorms are inspected. When the kids go to sleep, somebody must make sure there's a roll call taken and they know each child is in bed. In the morning, the same.
So do you think that now that we have these very high profile events, these tragic events with all these children dying in fires, that there will be accountability? People will demand that somebody answer for this and that somebody fixes it.
It will be there, but I can tell you, in Kenya, we are always a reactionary society. We react when it is burning. After 2-3 weeks, when something else comes up, everybody will forget that we lost, especially the government itself, they will forget that we lost children in Hillside and Arasha Academy. And it will be left for the school to now deal with the parents. So this consistency and sustainability in fighting some of these things, it's also lacking. We start inspecting schools right from that time and make sure it is a routine thing, whether there's an incident or not. I would like to see the participation of the government till the end, and then they should come up and say, this particular fire was caused by A, B, C, D.
Can you tell us, for those people listening right now, what are the three topmost safety requirements for us if we should be facing a fire in the building? If there's a fire, do you try and put it out or do you leave the building, alert somebody? What do you do?
RHF. The first one, run if you can. Get out of that place and escape. Two, if you can't hide, get a safe place to hide. If you can't hide in a safe place or there is no place for you to hide, then you have no alternative than now fight. Fighting should be the last option. If you know how to operate a fire extinguisher, fight the fire.
Okay, so if you're fighting a fire, for instance, you don't know what caused the fire. People's first instinct is to throw water on the fire. We're talking about a situation where there are no fire extinguishers.
You will fight with what you have at hand. If you have buckets, you have a tap where you can get the water, try and pour that water. But also the danger is this. Sometimes you can try to put off a fire, electrical fire with water, because electrical fires are very, very dangerous.
Right. So don't use water in electric fire or when petrol is being burned. So can we put sand on that or can we cover it with a blanket? So let me summarize. If it's an electric fire, don't use water. If it's a petrol fire, don't use water. Use sand or smother it with a blanket. But actually, run.
Please, if you can, run.
Julius Ogoni, a disaster management specialist. Zambia and Zimbabwe are facing severe electricity shortages, with Zambia being the worst affected. Things are so bad that some residents in the capital, Lusaka, are going several days without electricity, while Zimbabwe is facing up to 18 hours of power outages a day. The causes for these shortages are different to the reasons why South Africa had recently been suffering a lack of power, or load shedding, as it's called. The cause of the shortages for Zimbabwe and Zambia is a lack of water in the dam that powers their economies, Kariba. A severe drought is behind the low water levels, and so Zambia is going to have to shut down the turbines that generate power. We'll hear what the power utility ZESCO intends to do shortly. But first, how are people coping?
The power crisis has literally turned our lives upside down. As I speak to you now, we have not had electricity for a good 2 days. Now the people that we buy foodstuffs from the butcheries are having to invest in generators, which has doubled or even tripled the price of goods because they are also fitting in their cost of fuel, their cost of the genset into, and they need to recover that from ourselves. So the load shedding has equally affected the price of goods and even services.
As a software engineer, I rely heavily on electricity to power the gadgets I need to work, such as laptops. In my area, which is Kablonga, we often experience power outages for up to 21 hours a day, with the electricity typically returning between 5 and 6 a.m. While I have considered alternative power solutions, the costs are prohibitively high.
We have to now constantly be on the lookout of power when it comes, if at all it comes. However, in as much as there is this power crisis, I think it's also a rude awakening for an ordinary citizen for the alternative power sources.
I mean, I have been able to invest in a small generator, at least to enable me, you know, charge my phone, charge my laptop and my other devices, charge my lights. But this also comes at a cost. My cost of petrol has increased quite significantly. Small tasks as well, or tasks that we would consider small, such as cooking, you know, have also become quite difficult because usually I would cook on a stove, on an electric stove. But now, because I have not been able to get a gas stove, I am forced to cook on a brazier every day, which, you know, obviously increases charcoal consumption. For me, it's worrying in terms of the long-term consequences on our environment with how much charcoal we are using.
Those voices from Lusaka. Matongo Maumbi is the company spokesperson for ZESCO, Zambia's national power utility. So what's the problem and what's the plan?
Zambia, like many parts of the region, have been receiving quite some good rains in the past, but there have been indications of receiving a drought, reduced rainfall, especially if you're looking at the pattern from the 90s up to now. There's been a steady decrease in terms of water allocations, water that is being received, especially through rains. So this drought actually reduced the water levels to an extent where even the allocation of the water that can be used for hydropower generation, which is allocated by the Zambezi River Authority, was greatly reduced.
How much of Zambezi electricity comes from which sources? So hydro, geothermal, solar? Give us a breakdown.
We have hydro stands at 86%. Then the rest are sharing the 14% with the thermal, and the solar is just growing. Now, solar is just under 1 or 2%.
So hydro is by far the most important. Is the Kariba Dam the biggest supplier of the electricity in Zambia?
The Kariba Dam supplies almost 40%. When it's fully functional, it can give about 1,080 megawatts of power. And then the others, they come in like Kafue Gorge, Upper Kafue Gorge, Lower, which give about 990, 750 respectively. And then the other ones are smaller ones, which give just about 150 and much smaller. But in terms of generation, Kariba, when all things are good, is actually the biggest that we have in the country. And it's the oldest that we have.
Kariba is not so good at the moment. There's even talk of a shutdown.
Not at all.
What would that mean for Zambia?
The power deficit would actually be much larger than it is now. We're talking of at least 300 megawatts being off from what we're already having as a deficit. We're hoping that would mitigate this through other means, especially through imports. But there are some other challenges that are happening there. But the imminent shutdown of Kariba is likely any day this week. So they're just trying to see how we can manage the available waters that we have for power generation. So people would go to Kariba, they'll see the waters, but then it's not all the waters that they see there that can be used for power generation.
So will that mean that Zambia goes dark, or does that mean that certain places, certain facilities are going to be privileged over the others, you know, get electricity supplied because they are necessary and others will have to do without?
Yeah, definitely. We anticipated the shutdown of Kariba such that when we started the power rationing, the load shedding, we were doing it for 8 hours a day from March. Then we increased somewhere in May to 12 hours. Then as of 1st September, we were supposed to have increased to 17 hours of load shedding and supplying power to about seven hours in residential areas especially. And that was already factored in. However, from the 22nd of August, we couldn't receive the desired or the ordered quantum in terms of power imports because there was a problem on the converter on the Namibian side to transmit power to Zambia. So this led to a number of residential customers receiving power as low as 3 hours a day. But this has made us to prioritize the key sectors of the country, the critical sectors, because even as we do the power rationing, there are some institutions we cannot and we are not load shedding. Examples are hospitals, the mining industry, you're talking of the agricultural sector, you're talking of water pumping stations and security wings and a few other critical areas that do not have to be load shed.
As a South African, when you said load shedding, I got PTSD. Because some sectors like hospitals and so on were not exempt from load shedding. It got that bad. How are you mitigating the impact of, you know, this looming shutdown? Are you able to get power elsewhere?
We're importing power from Mozambique and we're also importing power from South Africa, which has been helpful, especially in mitigating the shortfall that we have, especially when you look at the mining industry. The imported power is quite expensive, but the mining industry and a few other industry players have been able to pay for that differential expense in terms of that power, making it also possible for us to supply in critical areas like hospitals. So with these power imports, we've been able to do some mitigation as well as doing a lot of customer education in terms of being power efficient, using power efficiently. And also government has put in place solar initiatives where we are coming in the form of projects to do with the net metering and also opening up the electricity grid to private sector in the form of open access to electricity use in Zambia, as well as opening up the mini grid where people or investors can put up to 5 megawatts of power without the vigorous hand of the energy regulator. And we are also putting up solar plants across the country that in the medium to long term can be of relief to what we have. Because what we are looking at as a corporation is to reduce that dependency from 86% to draw it to below 60%. This drought has affected a number of countries in Southern Africa. But when you look at East Africa, they are not so much affected. They actually have excess electricity. But because we don't have any interconnector to East Africa, we can't get power from there. So there's a project that is going on, the Zambia-Tanzania-Kenya project, that is to connect Zambia or Southern Africa to East Africa through Tanzania and Kenya, where we can do power trading. We're also working on something for Angola and also having a line from Mozambique into Zambia, because currently even the power we are getting from Mozambique has to go through South Africa, Botswana, into Zambia.
I'm wondering how long before these plans come on stream, and how long can you manage the emergency measures that you've put in place now? How long can Zambia manage to keep that going?
The rains are predicted to start in October, and then where we have the biggest hydropower, it takes them 2 or so months for the waters to fully reach. With the measures that we've put, we're hoping that they would last us until we have good enough waters to resume generation if Kariba will still be down, and also beef up generation on these others that are down. Something that we've also done is through working with government, we've managed to procure emergency diesel generators for the immediate relief because of the challenge of not being able to isolate, say, market areas, hospitals. So what we are doing is we are going to isolate, say, a market area or a hospital from the rest of those that are connected to that grid, so that when we do load shedding, that particular installation can have backup power, and then we can be able to switch off other areas. It will offer a bit of relief in the now. The cost, of course, is quite high, but it is offering quite some relief in the now.
Mr. Maumbi, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Matongo Maumbi, company spokesperson for ZESCO. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
The most famous wrestler in Iranian history.
When Ghulam Reza Takhti entered, there was chaos.
Whose legend is surrounded by mystery.
Really? Takhti died? How come?
Immediately the rumors started.
Legend of Takhti.
Was Takhti actually trying to provoke the regime?
Part of amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service.
There's this massive landslide of myth, and somewhere in there is the truth.
Search for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
We are in Sierra Leone now, where agriculture is the backbone of the economy, employing over 60% of the population. Of that 60%, 70% of them are women. In the northwest of the country, where many women depend on farming, getting land is becoming really difficult. And it is made even more difficult by something called BORA, which ties land access to respect and social obligations rather than formal ownership. Originally, BORA involved giving gifts such as livestock, food, or other items to local landowners as a sign of respect and gratitude for being allowed to use their land. It didn't have a monetary value as such, but now it involves cash and not exchange. So how does this change affect women farmers in Sierra Leone? We'll be hearing from Bankole Theodore Toure, a postgraduate researcher into land use in Sierra Leone. But let's first listen to Marion, a young woman farmer who is directly affected by the changing nature of BORA.
If I want to farm, then I don't have the cash. The BORA is money you pay. I don't have that money to give them. You go into percentage. If I give you my land to farm, when you finish harvesting, you might give them 40% and then you take 60%. Some might take 30%, you take 70%. That's how it works. If you want to go for this BORA, they'll tell you categorically that I just don't want to give my land to a woman or a lady. I just want you to bring somebody as if, okay, this is your man. Or I want this man to stand by you. As if, you know, those people believe in traditions. They believe in leadership. So they just want somebody that will say, okay, I want the man to stand. If we are going to give, we hand over the land to the man and then you pay the money. We know that you're the one that is farming, but at least let the arrangement be in the middle of this individual.
Now to Bankole. How exactly does BORA work?
Basically, Bawa is a traditional means of token whenever you go into the elders or the chiefs, whether it's for land or you're seeking the honor of a woman in marriage, or you are going to introduce yourself for the first time in the community, or you're going to work in the community. So whatever engagement you have in communities is always a customary practice for you to give Bawa to the elders or the chiefs. And it becomes more common practice when it comes to land access for both women, migrants, and people from non-ancestral landowners. And so they give Bawa. Bawa was not monetized before now. You can give in the form of agricultural produce, rice, chicken, goats, whatever, or the produce you are harvesting at the end of the year. That was how it was, and it was not tagged at any cost or at any commodity. You can give the minimum you can, and it was just a sign of respect to the elders and the landowning families.
So how has that affected various people who would have used Bawa as a means of cultural exchange and respect, and that now being monetized and with land being so much in demand, it means that the highest bidder gets the prize? How does it affect the other people who perhaps won't have the money to pay the price?
In most instances, they don't have access to land. And the Bawa in most communities is a must. It's not something you negotiate or you go around. You have to pay it. And if you don't pay it, you don't have access to land. In some other cases, they have to migrate. Some come to the bigger city to do other activities or find a job. And in other cases, most people, they ended up joining with other families or relatives who are engaging in farming activities who have paid. They provide them a cut from the total agricultural produce. So it becomes more challenging for particularly women who comes from many households that they cannot even meet their basic needs to raise the sum that in most instances land-owning family chiefs and others are asking them to pay. And so they ended up not having access to land at all.
And most of the farmers in Sierra Leone, I believe, are women, about 60 to 70% of them. So this practice affects small-scale women farmers particularly, right? How are they faring? How are they doing if there's a competition for land with other people or other institutions that want land?
Firstly, in my study, I picked it up that in most communities, women keep referring to that you have to pay Bawa for you to access the land. It was not a central theme of mine. This is basically looking at women's access and understanding the conflict in the peri-urban community. So Bawa comes up as a theme that I need to explore more to understand the dynamics of access when it comes to women. Some communities where they have organizations, both the government, non-governmental organizations, and civil society organization interventions, they have been able to lessen the burden of Bawa through cooperatives that have established within those communities, including women and men, trainings, empowerment, capacity, seed provision. So in most instances, Bawa is not something that is a challenge for them. And it has increased their productivity, it has increased their income. When you go to other communities who have less of these interventions from organizations, civil society organizations, and as well as the government, they are practically still stuck into the Bawa system, and their production is very low, income is very low. And so in the instance where they could not afford to pay the Bawa, in most cases, like I indicated earlier, they leave. Some leave the communities to go to urban areas where they can do petty trading and street hawking. Others ended up joining with other family members or relatives who are doing agricultural activities who have paid the Bawa. So it's more about the awareness that has been created for some community. It has reduced or lessened the impact of Bawa on their access to land. For other communities who have limited or no interventions from organizations, they are still struggling with the Bawa issue, and access to land is outwardly denied without Bawa.
We're talking about the numbers of women who are actually farmers in Sierra Leone. They're the majority of farmers in the country. How important is it for Sierra Leone to have women farmers?
Oh, it's very, very important. You know, women, they are like the communal consciousness of society. They contribute to the solidarity, the unity, social cohesion, and of course, the household nutrition. So they are very significant when it comes to nation building, from the household to the community, the larger society, and the country at large. In some instances, are the sole breadwinners. In some other instances, they are the cultivators, they are the producers, and they are in the market. So in all spheres of production, taking care of the home, society, you find women. And our society, by the last statistics, we have more women than men. And so depriving them of to an access to a very essential commodity, it's more like cutting their legs out from the start. And so land is an integral part of women's contribution to society, because bulk of their income is land-based. And majority of our population lives in rural areas. And in most of our rural areas, they're engaged in agricultural production. So land access is affecting women. Of course, it has a general effect on the nation's economy and specifically on the household and the communities.
So if women are so important to farming in Sierra Leone, how come they are not owners of land?
Well, firstly, we have to take an historical overview. Prior to colonialization, we have a strong patriarchal system where men are considered as the heads of household, and they are considered as the leaders in most families and in most communities. And so land predominantly in the customary setting is in the hands of men. So if a woman wants access to land, you have to go to your husband, your father, or your elder brother, or an uncle. So that has been in existence till independence. And so even after independence, this practice become widespread and more common. Men still control land. In fact, in the Northwest, where my study is based, all the traditional leaders, they're the male. And so it becomes very difficult when it comes to access to land for women in the community where leadership roles in community and household decision-making processes are being taken by men. And so women just serve as followers or just at the mercy of men in most instances. And so this structure has gone on for decades with men in control of land and women needing access to land have to go to a male figure for you to access land.
Now, we know that societies change, conventions change, mores change. Is there any sign that this pattern of ownership where men control access to land and women merely work it is changing? Can it change?
Yes, it can. It can change. There's so much effort that has been done. Currently, Sierra Leone becomes, I think, the first country in West Africa and for Africa as a whole after Tanzania to pass the Customary Land Act in 2022, together with establishing the Land Commission. And so those are like signs that with statutory instruments and continued engagement, things will change for the better. And then educate both men and women about the importance of women's access to land. We'll be able to beat this archaic tradition and custom that have held women for so long.
Bankole Theodore Toure, a Sierra Leonean doctoral scholar in sustainable urbanization. Focus on Africa was put together by Frenny Joey, Susan Gashui, and Charles Gitonga in Nairobi. Blessing Aderogba is in Lagos, and Bella Hassan is here in London. Our technical producer was Jack Raismark, the senior producer, Paul Bachibinga, and our editors, Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. Tomorrow morning, our sister podcast, Africa Daily, looks at what happened to some of Somalia's top basketball players after they were forced to flee from the civil war back in 1991. Alan Kasuja speaks to them about their annual reunions in a U.S. high school gym to share stories, reminisce, and of course, to play basketball. I'm Audrey Brown. Thanks for listening.
The most famous wrestler in Iranian history.
When Ghulam Reza Takhti entered, there was chaos.
Whose legend is surrounded by mystery.
Really? Takhti died? How come?
Immediately the rumors started.
Legend of Takhti.
Was Takhti actually trying to provoke the regime?
Part of amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service.
There's this massive landslide of myth, and somewhere in there is the truth.
Search for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.